We have the Lake Guru with us for Wisconsin Weekend, and we're exploring curious science-related questions about our inland freshwaters. Have you wondered about the color of the lake water, the clarity, the size of waves? It's our more than 15,000 lakes and 84,000 miles of streams up close and personal here on Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite Wisconsin lake? What's your relationship to your lake? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Ted Rulsey writes the column The Lake Where You Live, and he's active in lake advocacy organizations. He's the author of A Lakeside Companion that's published by UW Press. Ted, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, Kate, for having me on.
So how did you become the lake guy?
Well, I don't know if I'm the lake guy. I like to give a disclaimer that I'm not a scientist and I don't play one on the radio. What I know about lakes, I learned through some schooling in high school and college, through lots of personal observation, quite a bit of self-study through conferences and seminars. And so I don't know as much about lakes as, say, someone who's a lake specialist for the DNR or someone with the university, but spend a lot of time around lakes, love them dearly, and that's how I came by what I know.
Birch Lake is your passion. It's where you center yourself on your lake. How has that become kind of like your, you know, the place you write about and really think reflectively about water?
Well, I became addicted to water at a pretty young age. My father, when I was about 8 years old, took my brother and me to a lake in the Upper Peninsula with a coworker of his and two of his sons. And we stayed in this rustic cottage with no electricity, just kerosene lamps and a gas stove. And it became addicted to the big wilderness, and was bit by the Northwoods bug, and always have endeavored to get back there ever since I was a kid. Finally, I was able to move up there full time about 5 years ago. Birch Lake is about 20 miles southeast of Minocqua, and my family vacationed there for a long time before we actually bought the property in 2009 that we live on now. It's interesting. We were on the last day of our vacation in 2009, and I saw a for sale sign next to this reed bed, and I said to myself, if I cast a lure next to that reed bed right in front of that for sale sign and I get a fish, then we're supposed to buy this property. As it happened, I did catch a fish, about a 19-inch bass, and released it, and the rest is history. We built our house, and somewhere in Birch Lake swims a very expensive fish.
I love the story. Oh, thank goodness you caught it. So you write that the walleye or bass you may fish for owe their existence to the sun. It all starts with the sun. How does the sunlight in Wisconsin contribute to the characteristics of our lakes and the organisms that live within it?
Well, let's start with the idea that a lake is really, lake water is not just pure water, it's actually a very nutritious, thin soup. The broth is nutrient-rich water. The vegetables are little tiny microscopic plants called algae, and the meat would be the tiny animals that we call them plankton that eat the algae. Now, what happens, what drives all the energy in the lake is that the sun shines on the water, and the algae produce food by a process called photosynthesis, which many of us are familiar with. It's how plants make their food. So the sun helps the algae to create the food, the energy source for the lake. Then those tiny plankton eat up the algae. The baby fish eat up the tiny plankton. Bigger fish eat the little fish, and so on all the way up the food chain to the top. So that it's really the sun that's responsible for the walleye that you put on your dinner plate.
And it's those sunsets that you really cherish looking out from your pier.
Yes, we do face northwest, and so we get excellent sunsets.
Ted Rolsey writes the column The Lake Where You Live. He's author of A Lakeside Companion. Do you frequent one of Wisconsin's lakes in the summer, or ice fish, or skate in the winter? Tell us about your experience, 800-642-1234. Do you ever wonder about what's going on under the surface? What questions do you have about the fish, the plant life, the wildlife in and around lakes? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ted, lakes and groundwater are not separate. Essentially, all freshwater, lakes, streams, rivers, groundwater, rainfall, it's all interconnected, all interwoven. How does that work?
Well, it's the rainfall falls on the soil. Some of the rainfall is used up by plants and trees to for their sustenance, and the rest basically soaks into the ground. A lot of the rivers and streams, their source is really groundwater. So it's really all there is really only one water, and it's a cycle. The water evaporates off the surface of the lake and then falls as rain. A lake is really in an important sense. The top of the groundwater is known as the water table, and a lake is really an area where the landscape intersects that water table.
Right now, we're putting a lot of salt on our sidewalks. We're de-icing roads. How readily does that salt concoction find its way into our groundwater?
It's becoming more and more of an issue, and it really is dependent on a lake, for example, is affected by the salt, more or less dependent on how close it is to a major highway. They've done some studies up north with Trout Lake is a big lake, for example, and that has really seen very little increase in salt content. But then there are a couple of lakes that they monitor that are right off of Highway 51, kind of near Trout Lake, and the salt content has gone up measurably in those. So it's a concern. The DNR, I know, is watching it real closely. I've been to a presentation or two of theirs, and there's a lot of effort on behalf of cities, for example, to optimize the use of salt, not to use more than they need, and to use different formulations of it. We can all help by being really sparing with the salt that we use. On my property on Birch Lake, I try not to use any salt. I have sand, and instead of melting salt on our sidewalk or driveway with salt, I'll throw sand down. It gives us traction, and we don't have to worry about that running into the lake.
What actions contribute to the quality of the water?
Well, the main thing is just the watchword I like to use is live lightly. Take it easy on your lake. We tend to, our lakes are under stress from development and from the encroachment of invasive species. So we've all got to think about when we're developing properties, when we're living on our lake, we have to think about the impact that we're having. One of the best things that you can do to protect your lake is to plant a buffer strip or alongside from the water's edge up 10, 20, 30, 40 feet. Let that go natural. What that does is the water running off your property can be carrying nutrients and sediment. And what that buffer strip will do is slow down the flow of that water so that it soaks into the soil instead of running into the lake. So the nutrients, the phosphorus, the nitrogen in the runoff, instead of feeding algae in the lake, it's feeding the plants on your shoreline. But in general, also taking good care of your septic system, if you have one, to make sure that that's functioning properly. Just generally be conscious of the impact that you're having.
We're getting practical answers to the questions about our lakes with Ted Rolsey as our guide. He writes the column, The Lake Where You Live, and his new book is called A Lakeside Companion. What do you want to know about your favorite lake? We're at 800-642-1234. Do you ever wonder about what's going on under the water? What questions do you have about the fish, plant, and wildlife in and around lakes? What do you want to know about fishing on our lakes? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're at asking questions about our lakes on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming out of that polar vortex and a warm-up, it's a good time to talk about ice on lakes. We learn in the book A Lakeside Companion that the ice on our lake likely never gets more than 2 or 3 feet thick, no matter how long and cold the winter. Do you ice fish or skate in the winter? Tell us about that experience. Do you ever wonder about what's going on under the ice? Call in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Author Ted Rolsey stays with us. He writes the column The Lake Where You Live. He's active in lake advocacy organizations. John sent us an email and says, I live near Lake Superior and moved here about 8 years ago because of the Great Lake. I love the small, fun communities up here, and it is truly because of Lake Superior and our love of her that we are all up here. The lake, the future of the lake, and clean water are all on the people's hearts and minds up here. So wonderful sentiment there, Ted.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm actually a Lake Michigan boy myself. I grew up in Two Rivers, which is on the shore of Lake Michigan, south of Green Bay, about an hour north of Milwaukee. And so I can really empathize with this reader. I guess I think of Lake Michigan more or less as my mother, and the lakes up north that I love are my pals. They're, they're a little more accessible, a little more inviting. Lake Michigan, though, is definitely in my blood, and I can see why someone would have the same feeling about Lake Superior.
So there are 6 different kinds of lakes. They're classified by how they get their water. Using that metric, what kind of lakes are the Great Lakes?
Well, the Great Lakes would be... Boy, my expertise is more in the inland lakes, but the Great Lakes are, they get their water from all kinds of sources. They're just so huge.
So you live on Birch Lake, which is very close to Sand Lake, but the two bodies of water have very different characteristics. How can lakes that are so close to each other have such different properties?
That's a really interesting thing. There's a lot of research going on now dealing with the impact of landscape position on the character of a lake. And landscape position means the height in terms of the watershed, the drainage area of the lake. The lake that's across the lake from Birch Lake is called Sand Lake, and it is sort of at the apex of a little watershed there, a drainage area. And Sand Lake basically gets its water from the groundwater and from rainfall. It would be a what we call a seepage lake. Gets its water mostly from groundwater. Because it has a very limited area that drains into it, and therefore it's a very clear lake. It's about 40 acres, but very clear. You can almost see down to the bottom in about 15 or 20 feet of water. Then water comes out of Sand Lake and goes through a small marshy lake called Seed Lake, and from there a stream brings it into Birch Lake. And Birch Lake is not quite as clear as Sand Lake, but it is a little higher in nutrients, a little more productive in terms of fish life. Water clarity is not as high. Then the water comes out of Birch Lake and runs into Bearskin Lake, and that lake has more nutrients, more weeds. So as you progress down the landscape, so to speak, the lakes change greatly in character.
Let's go to the phones now with Sean joining us from New London. Hi, Sean. What about your lake?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
There's a lake in Ling Lake County called White Lake, and it's a spring-fed lake. I've been going up there my whole life, vacationing in the town by the same name. And my question is, what's the difference between a lake that is spring-fed, like White Lake, and other types of lakes?
Okay, White Lake is, I've been past there. It looks like a very pretty lake. The Birch Lake that I live on, the difference between White Lake and the lake that I live on is that my lake has a stream coming in and a stream coming out. Your lake is what we would call a seepage lake. My lake is what we'd call a drainage lake. Your lake is likely to be much more clear and clean because you're not taking in if you have a stream coming into the lake, then that stream is influenced by all the land that drains into that stream. And that could include farmland, it could include a village or a city. So there's lots of sources of nutrients and pollution that can come into the lake through that stream. You don't have that issue. On Birch Lake, we do have a stream coming in, but it's mostly a stream that flows through forested land, so it brings in relatively clean water. There's also another type of lake that's actually quite uncommon, but it's called a perched lake, not because it has perch in it, because it's perched up above the water table. And that lake is kind of isolated from everything else, so it's totally dependent on the rainfall to keep its level up. And if you get a drought year, a perched lake is going to drop in level considerably. Actually, a spring-fed lake, a seepage lake, will also be quite affected by drought, because the water table will drop in those dry periods.
Sean, does that make sense?
It does. Thank you very much.
So you also can test the clarity of a lake with this disc thing you put down there. Is it called a Secchi disc?
It's called a Secchi disc, yeah. It's a tool that scientists use to measure. It's a way to measure the clarity of a lake. Water clarity is actually a really important component of property value. People are willing to pay more money. It's been documented in studies recently in Vilas and Oneida County that water clarity will greatly increase the value of a property compared to a lake that's not as clear. But what a Secchi disc is, it's sort of like if you imagine a circle that's painted in quadrants, black, white, black, white, and you run that Secchi disc down on a rope over the side of a boat, over usually the deepest part area of water in the lake. And you watch that Secchi disc as it goes down. And when it disappears, then you lower it a little farther and bring it back up. And then the rope on the Secchi disc is graduated in feet. You pull the Secchi disc up and you note how many feet deep the Secchi disc was before it disappeared. And that is how, that tells you how deep the light penetrates into the water. And incidentally, how deep the light penetrates into the water dictates the depth to which rooted plants will grow in the lake.
I love how you also say keep note of that through the seasons in your lake cabin to just see the fluctuations.
Right. I'm the Citizens Lake Monitoring volunteer for Birch Lake, and I'm required to take Secchi disc readings about every 10 days to 2 weeks. In the springtime, we'll get a Secchi disc reading of 14 to 15 feet. That's the Secchi disc is 14 to 15 feet down below the surface before it disappears and you can't see it. And what that means is that the light is actually penetrating 28 to 30 feet down, because in order for you to see the disc, the light has to penetrate through the water and then back up to your eyes. But then in summer, gradually the water clarity declines because the algae are proliferating. And then in fall, sometimes we get what we call a algae bloom. We don't get too severe algae blooms on our lake. But when that happens, the Secchi disc reading will be down to maybe 4, 5, 6 feet.
So this time of year, we have a lot of ice on lakes. How does ice form in Wisconsin's lakes?
Well, we're definitely making ice today, that's for sure. It's interesting. One of the characteristics of water is that it takes a lot of work to form ice. If you have, let's say you have water at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the freezing point of water, it takes a tremendous amount, the water has to give up a tremendous amount of energy to turn from that liquid water into ice. In fact, it takes about 80 times as much energy pulled out of that water by the cold air to turn that into ice than it would take to raise that, to lower the temperature of that water by 1 degree Celsius. So it takes a lot of cold days in a row and generally still nights for the ice to begin forming. Once it does form, it'll form a sheet over the lake, starting at the shoreline and edging out, and then on a cold, clear night, the lake will freeze into a sheet. After that, the speed at which the ice forms is really dependent on how cold it stays and for how long. And the thicker the ice gets, the more slowly it develops, because it has that, it's insulated by snow, and then the ice itself has a degree of insulating value. Right now, on Birch Lake, I can tell you by having tried to drill through the ice with my hand auger for ice fishing, we have about 2 feet of ice on Birch Lake right now. That would probably be pretty standard across the Northwoods.
Pretty standard right now in a typical year, or did that polar vortex really solidify things?
The polar vortex helped us make more ice. It's going to take a while to melt all this. Last year, we had an interesting thing happen. We had a winter that persisted all the way into middle of April. We were still freezing cold, April 17th, 18th, and we had the ice so thick that fishermen couldn't even drill to the bottom of it with their power augers. Some of them, they had to get extensions on their augers. And I was saying to myself, boy, we're not going to be able to get on the lake to go fishing until the middle of May. But what happened was we went directly from freezing cold into summer, and so that by the time fishing opening day came along, the lake had opened up.
Yeah, Mother Nature said, just wait, I've got you covered.
That's right.
It's all questions asked about our lakes and their ecosystems on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. Author and columnist Ted Rolsey is our guide. His book is A Lakeside Companion. Are you willing to share your favorite fishing, boating, or hiking spot? What is your favorite lake and why? Give your lake a shout out at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll continue the conversation, perhaps hear from you on the Ideas Network. We're talking lakes and fish on Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is A Lakeside Companion, and Ted Rolsey gives props to the fish that frequent our lakes. He calls northern pike the people's fish. They don't get respect. Muskie, king of the lake, ambush feeders. Crappies, angels of the lakes. Sunfish, freshwater jewels. What is your crown jewel lake or fish? What do you love to fish for? Where do you find peace on a lake? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Author Ted Rolsey is ready for any and all questions and suggestions about enjoying our lakes. So, Ted, Wisconsin is figuring out how to deal with nutrient pollution in our water, and lakes need nutrients, but there can be too much of a good thing. To explain phosphorus's role in all of this, you use the metaphor of a Friday fish fry. Can you help us make that connection?
Right. Phosphorus is what the scientists call a limiting nutrient. There are three main nutrients that water plants need to survive, and we need water plants. Water plants are not bad. Algae is not bad. They're very important to the lake, but everything in moderation. But phosphorus is a limiting nutrient. In other words, that's the nutrient that's maybe in short supply. Now imagine that you're a restaurant and you want to serve fish fries to people. Let's say you have 100 pounds of perch and 100 pounds of French fries, but only 2 pounds of coleslaw. You can only serve too many complete fish fries that way. So phosphorus, as far as the lake is concerned, is kind of like the coleslaw. If you start adding coleslaw, pretty soon the algae and the plants can really go on a feast. I was talking to the executive director of the Green Lake Association, who told me that 1 pound of phosphorus added to a lake can contribute to the growth of 500 pounds of algae. So it's really important that we regulate the amount of phosphorus that gets into our lakes.
Moderate those fish fries.
That's right.
So let's go way back in history. Glaciers are responsible for the topography of North America. Can you explain how glaciers work and how did they create Wisconsin's landscape?
Yeah, they created Wisconsin's landscape basically by very slowly creeping across the landscape and carving out the depressions that later filled with water and became our lakes. It was interesting to me in researching for this book how glaciers move. I had kind of always pictured this giant sheet of ice kind of sliding by gravity down out of Canada, and that really isn't the way it goes at all. Movement to the south is really not downhill, even though it looks that way on the globe that we have on our shelf. The way the glaciers move, you can get sort of a rough analogy to that by pretending you have a bucket of sand and you stand and you start pouring that sand out on the ground. It'll form a conical shape, and as you keep pouring on more sand, the base of the cone will widen, spread out. And that's kind of what happened with glaciers. There's a great deal of, there's thousands of feet thick, and the sheer weight of all this ice and snow caused the glacier to spread out from its center. And that's how it spread across Wisconsin and carved out the lakes.
I love that visual, too, of the sand there, and that really does help explain. Let's go to Kate now, joining us from Minocqua. Kate, hi.
Hi. This was quite a surprise, Ted, to wake up to your voice this morning.
Well, thank you.
Anyway, I just wanted to let you know that Jason gave us your book for Christmas, and I have learned just so much in little segments reading after breakfast or lunch, you know, like 3 or 4. It has just been a delight. The interesting thing, I had no idea that you could tell a fish age from the scale with their rings. So I hope you'll tell people about that. I just found it delightful.
And Kate, can you give a shout out to your lake?
Oh, we live on Big Crawling Stone Lake on the Flambeau Reservation.
And can you explain what the lake looks like a little bit for us?
Well, it's sort of like in two shapes. Our shore looks out, and then there's kind of like a, it comes in with two little points, which is, it's still wide there, but that's the deepest part of the lake, about 8. And then, I can see the larger part and through to the other side of the lake, but I almost have to have binoculars. I think our lake is maybe 1,300 acres. And we're on a chain of 10 lakes on the reservation. So,
well, Kate, thank you so much for calling in. Well, we got to get to the fish and the scales.
Yeah, that's interesting. I recently went ice fishing, caught a few bluegills, and I gave my grandson Tucker a microscope for Christmas. So after I cleaned the bluegills, I took a few scales, put them in a plastic bag, and took them to Tucker. And his, Tucker's dad is a science teacher, so I gave Tucker the scales to look at through a microscope, and I told him how you can tell how old a fish is by the rings on the scales. And he was able to determine that the fish that I cleaned were some 2 and some 3 years old. Fish are born with all the scales that they'll ever have, and as the fish grows, the scales grow out at the outer edge, and kind of like the rings on a tree. And during the winter time, when the fish are less active, the scales form a ring, and by those rings you can tell the age of the fish. If there's three of those heavy rings on a fish scale are called an annulus, and if there's three of those, then the fish is 3 years old. You can also tell how fast the fish grew by the amount of space between the rings.
They wear their age on their body.
Yes, they do.
Like a tattoo. Well, Bill emailed and said, Ted, you mentioned some citizen science you do regarding water clarity. Do you know of similar opportunities that are available through the DNR or other organizations for those with lake property?
Oh, the Citizens Lake Monitoring Network would be the one that comes right to the top. You can easily search that up online. There's a network of volunteers around the state who monitor their lakes for their water clarity. Some also do monitoring of chlorophyll, I believe, and dissolved oxygen, a little more detailed monitoring. And the value of this is that the DNR can only afford to have so many people that they're paying to go out and test the water. And by having these citizen scientists, we can add a lot of data to the system that helps the DNR manage its lakes. There's other ways to get very involved in lakes. You can join your local lake association or your county lake association. So those are some. UW Extension Lakes is a great website to visit for all kinds of information about lakes and how you can get involved.
And you can find that link on WPR's morning show page at WPR.org. So lakes aren't the same temperature all the way through. There's actually a point where it changes. Can you explain thermal cline and how we can find out where it is?
Oh, sure. Lakes, I like to say your lake has layers. At least it does in the summertime. In the springtime, your lake is pretty much uniform in temperature after the ice goes out. Then as the water warms up, warm water is less dense than colder water. So what happens as the water warms up during the summer, you have a layer of warm water on the top and a layer of much cooler water on the bottom. Now, if you were to, the zone where the temperature gradient happens is called the thermocline. That's kind of the boundary between the upper and the lower levels of the lake. And you can experience the thermocline by going out into your lake, swimming out to where the water is probably, 15, 20 feet deep or more. Then you do one of these feet-first surface dives and propel yourself down. And you'll have warm water, then all of a sudden your feet will hit water that's noticeably colder. And what's happened there is your feet have punched through the thermocline into that colder lower layer.
You can actually feel that change.
You can definitely feel it. It's very distinct. The water on the surface in summertime might be in the low to mid 80s in temperature. And then when you hit that thermocline and get below that, it's going to be in the 60s, the 50s. So it's very pronounced change all of a sudden.
Ted Rolsey is our guide. He is the author of A Lakeside Companion. You can join in 800-642-1234. Are you connected to the commerce that depends on the Great Lakes? How important are they for your industry? Have you seen the waters change and evolve over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ted, sometimes you'll see a fish appear above the water's surface, and sometimes they're doing a few things simultaneously. What are these fish doing? Why do fish jump?
Well, for various reasons. If you're talking about steelhead trout or salmon, they might be jumping to get up above a dam or to climb a fish ladder. There are some nuisance.
Wait, a fish ladder.
Those are out in the western states to help the salmon migrate up the streams.
Ah.
Yeah. They jump from layer to layer to layer so that they don't have to swim all the way up against the rapids, which they couldn't do. On the Illinois River down south of Lake Michigan, we have the Asian carp, these nuisance species, and they jump out of the water as a fright response to motorboats going by. We hope those never get into Lake Michigan. Otherwise, fish on our lakes, if you see little tiny minnows jumping across the surface, there's a pretty good bet that they're being pursued by a predator fish. If you see a larger fish jump, that might be because that fish is coming up underneath a school of smaller fish trying to catch them and ends up flying out of the water. Generally, though, it's maybe when it comes to why fish jump, there is no why. Sometimes they just do.
I love it. Sometimes you see an insect like a spider almost walk on water. How are they able to do that?
The water strider you're talking about, they have little rounded structures on the ends of their feet that float on the surface tension of the water. The surface tension is kind of like a thin skin on the water. It isn't really a skin, but it's a way that the molecules of water interact. Water molecules are more attracted to other water molecules than to the air. So there is just a little bit of a tension before one breaks through the water. It's called surface tension, and the water strider more or less glides along on that surface tension.
We're on a lake expedition with author Ted Rolsey as our guide. His new book is A Lakeside Companion. It's published by UW Press. You can join in your questions about lake life front and center at 800-642-1234. Do you take your family out on the lakes in the summer or any season? What are your traditions? What's important to you about interacting with many freshwater bodies? Call in, tweet us. We'll be back for more Wisconsin Weekend in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're exploring Wisconsin's more than 15,000 lakes on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is The Lakeside Companion, and Ted Rolsey writes, if you're like many lake dwellers, you're protective of your lake's fish. You're careful not to do things that would harm spawning areas or otherwise hurt the fish population. How are you protecting a lake? How are you advocating for a lake? Did you grow up in a lake community? How do you think about conserving your resources? The number is 800-642-1234. Still time for you. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ted, tell us the story of when on a cloudy, windy day you saw some bald eagles. What happened there?
Oh, that was just amazing. I had It was a kind of a nasty day, and I usually go down to the lake most days, but this day I was sort of, well, boy, I don't know, I think I'm going to stay inside, but I decided, well, I'll go down there anyway, and the wind was blowing kind of almost enough to blow me off the pier sometimes, but all of a sudden I look up, and there's a bald eagle, and then pretty soon there's two, and then all of a sudden there's an osprey, and it was like this aerial ballet of these eagles and ospreys flying sometimes directly over my head, so I was looking straight up in order to see them, and almost enough to make me lose my balance. It was just a reminder to get out and visit with your lake any time, any season. You'll be usually delighted at what you discover.
Yeah, there's never a dull moment.
No, there isn't.
You said we may be in danger of loving our lakes to death. What do you mean by that?
Well, I kind of talked about that earlier. It's a question of lakes are threatened by overdevelopment. If you get too much development on a lake that's not done responsibly, you can actually cause pollution that takes a lake past a tipping point. And the way we avoid that is to develop our properties responsibly, to keep our shorelines natural especially, to maintain our septic systems, and just to be restrained in what we build and kind of let nature take its course. If everybody on a lake would plant a lawn, for example, that has a very negative impact. We should try to keep the impervious surfaces to a minimum. And just generally, like I was saying earlier, live lightly and think about not just yourself and your neighbors, but all the people who are going to visit the lake and treasure the lake just as much as you do.
You have this methodical, painstaking tradition of putting in the pier, but you savor every step of this chore. Can you tell us more about putting in the pier?
Oh, that's a favorite ritual of spring. The ice goes out on my lake, and I'm probably down there the next day with my ratchet wrench and square and level and putting that pier together. I have the kind of pier that goes together like a child's erector set, which is kind of adds to the childish joy of putting it in. It's just a nice way to take my time and just one piece at a time assemble this pier and watch the wildlife that goes by. We have a fallen pine tree right on the property next to ours. And last year while I was putting the pier in, this otter swam by and went and sat on that pine tree and was making these guttural growls at me like he didn't approve of what I was doing. But it's a very enjoyable job. It takes about an hour and a half to 2 hours, and I kind of dawdle along at it and enjoy it, especially for all that it portends, the 6 or 7 months of open water that we're about to have.
Well, we've covered so much ground here about lakes. Is there anything you wish people understood about our lakes? Are there any misconceptions that you really want to clear up?
Well, I guess my main reason for writing the book was that a lot of people don't really understand what they have in the lake that they live on or the lake that they visit. It's a pool of water to paddle a canoe on or take a boat ride on or swim in to cool off, but it's really so much more. There's a really interesting quote from Jane Goodall, who said that something, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but only when we understand can we care, only when we care can we help, and only when we help can we be saved. So, as I mentioned, our lakes are under a bit of stress, and the better that we understand the lakes, the more likely we are to appreciate what we have and care for them properly.
Ted, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Ted Relsey writes the column, The Lake Where You Live. He's active in lake advocacy organizations, and he's the author of A Lakeside Companion. That's published by UW Press. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story about a unique ice fishing tournament in Luck, Wisconsin.
A classic Wisconsin winter activity is making its way into the world of high school sports. Ice fishing teams are popping up in schools across the state. Taylor Pomisol recently threw on her parka to meet some of the student fish wranglers.
It's the first high school ice fishing tournament of the year. Coaches are distributing bait, Student fish wranglers are driving out onto the ice via four-wheeler to find the perfect fishing spot.
It's one of those things that if you do it as a kid, you start to do it as an adult and you can carry it on. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those, you know, one of those things that a kid should get the opportunity to do.
For these students, winter means spending time outside for a more non-traditional high school sport. Wendy Dahlman is the president of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Fishing Association and the head coach of Prairie Farm. She says high school ice fishing teams started in 2012, but there are already more than 1,200 students and 100 schools involved statewide.
This sport is growing every year, so it's pretty cool to see. As you drove in, you could see the amount of trailers and trucks and buses and whatnot in the parking lots.
Though the high school competition is new, schools across Wisconsin are getting involved. Jack Springett is in his second year at Amory High School.
It's different. Nobody does it, so why not? Mm-hmm. It's fun.
And sophomore CJ Peterson is hoping Somerset's new team can make an impactful debut.
Hopefully you can do good this year. Hopefully you place in top 20 schools.
Preparation for the Saturday tournament starts the week before. Teams are packing and organizing bait, while organizers check ice and prepare prizes. On the day of the tournament, students get up early and head to the lake. Michaelin Christensen is in her second year at Prairie Farm.
I got woke up at 5:30, and I laid in bed until 6.
Prairie Farm junior Briley Hansen says the day starts with finding the perfect spot to drill and set bait.
You find the depth, bring it up a couple feet, set the minnow on, and then set the tip up.
Guys, you got tip up.
The excitement and challenges.
You caught two already.
Don't stop until the fish are collected and the winner is determined. The season starts at the end of December and can go into March. Since the tournaments are on Saturdays, many students can balance their love of fishing and the outdoors with a school sport.
We're also in basketball, but this is like on the weekends and it's just a lot of fun. You get to spend time outside with your friends, and a lot of time we just sit in a heated shack and enjoy fishing while warm.
Dolman says being on the ice can teach people about balance, conservation, and natural resources. It also gives students with different backgrounds a chance to compete together. Most teams don't require any experience to join.
I had two girls out here that never handled an ice auger before, and they both drilled their own hole and set their own tip up, so. Mm-hmm.
Parents are also encouraged to enjoy a day on the ice with their fish wranglers.
And what a great bonding experience for families to get out with their kids and, mm-hmm. and you know, just be in the outdoors.
Christensen's dad, John Barthman, says the family's love of fishing and great memories on the ice make the cold Saturday mornings worth it.
Sometimes she teaches me, sometimes I teach her.
In the future, the sport hopes to expand throughout the Midwest and create more regional tournaments. A middle school component is being considered for the state.
That story was produced by Taylor Pomisel, a Wisconsin Public Radio intern based in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And if you have an idea for a Wisconsin weekend topic, we'd love to hear about it. Send your thoughts on a show to ideas@wpr.org. We love to hear your thoughts as we explore Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.